The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, Euro 2022, hours to go. I want to be sedated. England, Spain, home side get the fright on in Brighton, but come through with a win that was quite exciting. We'll talk Spain outplaying England, but not outstaying them, thanks to Georgia Stanway. We'll also have transfer talk. He's called Jaylings. Will Hammers fans clap him in the irons again? And we'll be looking back on the 2010 World Cup. From Jabalani to Gian, where is the love? All that and more coming up in this Totally Football Show. Dateline, July the 21st. And thank you for being with us, listener. It's an exciting Totally lineup for you today. There's Duncan Alexander's with us. Hi, Duncan.
Hello.
Also, Carl Anker returns. Hello, Carl.
Ahoy, hoy, James.
And from Pickfair, the best place to source your photographic needs, Benji Laniardo.
Hi, hoy.
Hello, James.
Yeah. 10 out of 10 for enthusiasm. We've got the Athletic Charlotte Harper along shortly to talk to us about England, Spain. What a game that was on Wednesday night. But in other news, Carl, you've got a new book out today, July 21st.
I do indeed. For the purely audio I'm holding up right now.
Okay. It says Marcus Rashford, this is the sequel to How to Be a Champion, and this one's entitled How to Stick to Football, Stay in Your Lane, and Score Some Goals and Help Your Team Out. Is that right?
It is called You Can Do It, How to Find Your Voice and Make a Difference.
Brilliant.
And it is the sequel to You Are a Champion. It's in all good bookstores now. And I hope if you enjoyed You Are a Champion, you might be inclined to pick up this new book.
Excellent. How to Be a Champion, Volume 1, was a massive success. How was Marcus? I mean, how was it also just kind of like working with him? Because he's such a special chap.
Yeah, I'd describe the relationship a bit like the one between an architect or a builder, or if you please, if you're making lager shandies. So
right,
he's the lager, I'm the shandy, and then we make a nice
you'd be the lemonade.
Yeah,
I think
make a refreshing little drink there.
But in the building motif that you're employing, would you're the contractor, are you, and he's the architect, is that right?
Or
are you
I'm very much the builder and put things together as he shows me the grand design that he
who's Kevin McLeod? Is that Eric Ten Hag?
I suppose he might be now.
But I'm just kind of mildly kind of starstruck. He's such a kind of, he's a young man with such a vision and such a kind of clear head. What's he like? Does he make jokes and stuff?
He does make jokes. He does often. I do often ask him questions for the benefit of the 10 to 17 year olds that I might be reading. So, you know, we talk about, I think I mentioned on this podcast before about how much he enjoys the Ninja Turtles, and we've gone even longer about how much he enjoys the Ninja Turtles. I asked him what were his childhood fears, to which he informed me he had a healthy respect for small dogs. So not necessarily the Rottweilers that were running around the area, but if it was
small
a Chihuahua
dogs
or something, that put him a little bit on edge. And we went back and forth on a number of concepts that, to him, were rather commonplace because he's been a professional football player since the age of, let's say, 13. But to try and explain that to civilians who like the snooze button might be a bit more difficult. So we had a conversation recently about how you bounce back after making a mistake in football. And obviously, considering his summer and some of the events that happened at Manchester United, he has to be very resilient and understand that one bad game or one bad season isn't the end of it. And we're having a long conversation about how you just need to get past that. And he gave me the metaphor of making pancakes. And he said, obviously, you know, when you make a stack of pancakes, the first pancake is the worst one. But the first
pancakes.
Pancake is the most integral pancake to your entire stack. And that's how he views things when he has a bad game or a bad day.
That's the second best pancake metaphor I've heard of late. Top spot I would give to somebody who was giving my nephew relationship advice after it and said, relationships are like pancakes. The first one never comes out right, but that's fine.
Blimey. Well. Yeah.
There you go. Pancakes, everybody.
Best smothered in maple syrup.
I seem to remember that Sheffield Wednesday are the top scoring team on Shrove Tuesday in football history, but I can't confirm that right now.
But there you okay. go.
Also, but a friend of mine, my cousin, whose son used to play professional football, explained that that is the fundamental difference between, you know, the layman and the professional sportsman is the ability to bounce back. So, like, after, you know, England lost the Euros, for example, I mean, I wallowed for like a week. I was devastated. Whereas sports people, that is the difference between them and us. They can just move on much quicker than the layman.
I bet you've had to bounce back from adversity in your time, Benji.
Is this therapy?
I mean, no, just to say, I mean, not that you need to kind of take us through your ups and downs. I'm just saying that I'm sure you've had to. You've displayed bounce back ability in your time. Just it's something different, I guess, when your emotions are essentially hostage to somebody else's performance. That you're so much more passive in that relationship. That maybe that's why it takes you a little bit longer. But yeah, I'm sure that we've all had to deal. With annus horribilis. How's your annus been, Duncan?
It's pretty solid annus. Yeah, it's fine.
All right, then. Well, hey, speaking of bouncing back, adversity, sportsman, football, all that kind of thing, brings us on pretty nicely to events Wednesday night at the Amex Stadium in Brighton, when England came up against their toughest adversaries yet in Euro 2022, Spain. We're kind of played off the park a little bit for the first hour or so, and yet still emerged as winners and into a semi-final. Woof. Let's hear about an extraordinary night in Brighton next.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Space opening up for Georgia Stanway. Goes for goal! Oh, my word! What a screamer!
What a peach from Georgia. Surely. Yes, remarkable night then, a remarkable match. The Athletic's Charlotte Harper was at the Amex and joins us now. Charlotte, good morning.
Good morning.
Excellent. You're still in Brighton.
I am still in Brighton, yes. I'm just sitting in my hotel room, finished off my piece. So, yeah, the adrenaline is still pumping.
I can imagine. What was Wednesday night like there at the Amex?
I went into it thinking England should win this game. And considering Spain's group game performance, they hadn't really shown their true potential. And England, as we know, had blown teams away like Norway and Northern Ireland. And I felt confident. But the first 20 minutes, I just got nervous. that kind of sinking feeling in your stomach. We struggled. Spain were disciplined, organised. We knew Spain would have the ball. We knew that England would have to be comfortable with them having a lot of the possession. But the crowd were amazing, like awesome atmosphere, unbelievable. Like Spain had all of the ball, but they hadn't really created that much. And then that first goal, and you're just thinking, oh goodness, like, are we out here? I looked across to my colleague, Michael Cox, at 75 minutes, and I'm thinking, we're out. Like Spain, they're brilliant at going ahead and keeping the ball. They can keep the ball all day long. And then as soon as that equaliser went in, oh, the relief. And then after that, like you think going into extra time, people are really nervous and that's the horrible moment. But for me, as soon as we went into extra time, I just relaxed because England took the game to Spain. We were in control. We were much more dominant. We attacked using our wing play. And yeah, what a night. I mean, all the songs going around the stadium. I don't know how the players still had the energy to dance at the end, but Millie Bright and Rachel Daly were loving life and their legs must be knackered.
Yeah, indeed. There were some pretty ruthless substitutions by Serena Wiegmann straight after Spain had taken the lead. Is that where the game turned?
Definitely. I think those substitutions were really key. The fact that Alessia Russo came on, she was instrumental in that equaliser. Brilliant hold-up play to head down for Toon to tap in. Chloe Kelly as well. She just offers something different on the wing. And her trickery and her manoeuvres, I thought she had a very successful impact on the game. And a really smart decision from Serena Wiegmann to replace Daly, Rachel Daly, with Alex Greenwood. Now, Daly was being terrorised by Athena del Castillo and really causing problems on that right wing. Wiegmann put Greenwood on, but sent Bright up top as an aerial threat. Millie Bright's a centre-back. So instead of putting a forward on, puts Millie Bright up. And then when they equalise, Bright can go back to defence and they play as a back four. So switch from a started off back four, then Greenwood came on, went to back three, and then Goentin reverted to back four. And that was very astute from Wiegmann, I thought.
Were you there for the 8-0 against Norway?
I was.
Right. How did this compare? You only got the two goals this time, but as a victory, how important was this? How big an occasion was this?
This was huge because we were really tested. So for 84 minutes, we were under pressure. It was uncomfortable. We didn't have the ball. Whereas Norway, apart from the first 5 or 10 minutes, we barely felt threatened. I should say England, shouldn't I? My bias coming in. And then, you know, England just stormed to victory against Norway. Norway was lovely to watch because it was comfortable. We were free flowing. It was a celebration. Whereas this was grit and dogged and determination. And first time we've conceded since the Arnold Clark Cup in February. So to go down 1-0 and be down, like we conceded in the 54th minute and we equalised in the 84th minute. That's 30 minutes of holding your nerve.
What a way to take the victory in extra time through Georgia Stanway. England going through to the semi-final on Tuesday against either Sweden or Belgium. How nervous, Charlotte, are you about the semi-final, given the way that the difficulty seems to have ramped up after the group stage and given especially England's record in tournaments, losing in the last three tournament semi-finals that they've been in?
I think this was a really good measure of where England are at. And I think they'll take a lot from this game mentally of how they've come back. Well, it's worth bearing in mind, England have two extra recovery days as well. So Sweden play Belgium on Friday, semi-final on Tuesday. And that could be crucial just to get a little bit more recovery time. I expect Sweden to beat Belgium quite comfortably. And Sweden were picked as one of the favourites going into this tournament. Very cohesive as a team. They had, you know, not some outstanding performances in the group stages, but their last match especially, I think we saw them take another gear. Sweden have had a couple of COVID cases, though. They've been quite severely hampered at the back. So again, it will be kind of a race against time if those players can test negative. Regarding semi-final performances, yeah, we know we've been out in the last World Cup semi-final and the Euros against the Dutch as well. Under Serena Wiegmann, there's just a new mentality with this England team. It's not cocky, it's not arrogant. It's just they know their role, they know their strengths, and they're relaxed. I wouldn't say they were relaxed last night, but especially talking to them before the game, there is a certain air about this team and this camp that, you know, you take water breaks all together, not individually. And a real sense of collectiveness among them.
Mm. All right, well, Tuesday night then, either Sweden or possibly Belgium for England next. Germany-Austria is the next quarterfinal that's coming up tonight. You can hear how that one goes in the Athletic Women's Football Podcast first thing on Friday morning, because that show's with you every day throughout the tournament. Charlotte, thank you so much for taking time out there from your kind of post-game celebrations, neutral though they are. And we look forward to catching up with you again soon.
No problem. Thanks so much for having me on.
Crikey. What a game. I mean, Spain, it's a shame to see them go out. There was so much fun to watch. But yes, that Georgia Stanway goal.
The age-old stick the big man/woman up front and turn the game. good to see heritage being respected. But Millie Bright was brilliant. She won everything in the air all game, 8 clearances. And that was a, you know, tremendous performance. And, yeah, I think Charlotte makes a good point about the extra 2 days because a few of the players had cramp and stuff in extra time. Kira Walsh went off. Hopefully it was cramp rather than a hamstring injury. But, yeah, those extra 48 hours should hopefully make a big difference.
I'd say to echo what Charlotte was saying, Alex Greenwood, I thought, was flawless when she came on. And it did, and it's, I know it's an odd one to change the game, but it gave them so much more confidence to push on for the second, because Rachel Daly's confidence was slightly shot by then, and she was probably largely responsible for the first goal. And it just felt like, as soon as Greenwood was on, the whole team felt a little bit more confident about dealing with the ball coming in the opposite direction, so they could actually head forward with more purpose. Yeah, I thought, and she even got a lovely little tactical time-wasting yellow card towards the end. She was brilliant, stuck her head in to get, like, you know, accidentally, inverted commas, high kicked, this kind of stuff. She was brilliant.
It was a victory, a triumph of game management and a nice amount of cynicism. Georgia Stanway's goal was the epitome of, no, don't hit it from... Well done. Great goal. Fantastic.
All right, well, Tuesday they go again, and Friday we discover who England's opponents will be. Next up on the Totally Football Show, transfer news, and that will be also asking this question from Jan de Vossen-Mordenaar. Although there is still 40 days left, who has had the strongest transfer window? That's right. Answers on the way after this.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
All right, Jan de Vossen-Mordenaar, let's get an answer to your question. Who's had the strongest transfer window? City, Arsenal, Spurs, Chelsea, Barca, PSG, Forest even, says Jan. Forest have been busy. Carl, what's your answer?
My answer was the Ghanaian national team.
Lol.
Who have naturalised 6 players in preparation for the World Cup. They still haven't quite got a number 9, but as a man of Ghanaian heritage who was slightly anxious about it being in a group of death, I've started saying some very mean things about Luis Suarez and saying I want revenge. So
right.
I think that's been a particularly good transfer window.
Is this all raids from Chris Hughton? Is he just darting across the country?
Chris Hughton was brought in as a technical director specifically for the World Cup qualifier playoff against Nigeria.
Hmm.
Ghana defeated Nigeria and it looked as if that contract would have expired. But then it appears it's been extended because Chris Hughton is a lovely gentleman. And if you want someone to switch national team allegiances, you know, he's very good at that.
Who have you got, Carl? Who are the 6?
So one of the, I mean, the big name for the Premier League watches is Tarek Lemty.
Right.
And there's been a number of players across the diaspora, a lot of them in Germany as well, because George Addo is... Well, up until he became permanent manager, he used to be the assistant manager of Borussia Dortmund. Ghana's having a particularly interesting relationship with Dortmund now. It seems as if Dortmund are travelling over to Ghana more to have some sort of scouting partnerships. If we should talk about club football, I am very impressed by Spurs.
Okay.
Because Conte's a very interesting manager in that he doesn't really... He seems to be one of the very few managers that does blind CV tests, where he doesn't really care about the name. He just looks at... the profile of the player, and
unlike Chris Hughton, he just checks where they're born.
I'm just so excited to play Uruguay.
You know what? We'll talk more about Ghana and Revengi and all that stuff a little bit later on. But okay, Spurs, great shout. They've certainly done some business. Duncan, what would be your shout?
Until I get my time machine working, I can't really tell, because if you think about this time last year, everyone was laughing at Arsenal and saying, lol, they've bought Aaron Ramsdale, this silly. And, you know, a few months later, they were like, Arsenal have done a great transfer window. It's hard to tell. It's a bit like making judgments on pre-season friendlies. It's a fool's errand.
Right.
I'm wearing a clown nose right now.
No, but Duncan, that's the whole point. I mean, I don't get people who say I don't do predictions. I'd rather wait until we see.
No, I do predictions. I love predictions, but right. I think transfers are
okay. What about Man City? What about Man City? Who, even if they spend 50 million on Mark Cucurella to replace Zinchenko, will still have got him, Calvin Phillips, and the most in-demand striker in world football for buttons, basically. Their net spend, if you'll excuse the expression, is minimal, given the players that they managed to move on.
I think the interesting thing with Manchester City is, yes, you know, the top-level players they are moving on, Gabriel Jesus and Zinchenko, but also they've figured out, you know, the Liverpool trick of using the academy as a way to top up the transfer fund. So Southampton have pilfered the head of recruitment from Manchester City, and he appears to be taking a number of Manchester City's academy players over to Southampton, which, one, seems to be quite a good deal for Southampton, and two, seems to be a very... I want to use the term mates rates in terms of Man City getting a little bit of top up for their transfer fund, because obviously they've got someone outside who's bringing in some players as well. And obviously you can make the joke about how Arteta's doing Pep Guardiola a favour by chucking him an extra 20 million there. City are getting good at the transfer market, which was surprising to me, because they don't need to get good at the transfer market, at least in terms of outgoings.
Interesting to see what happens with Leeds. They've done what Spurs did when Gareth Bale went, which is essentially spend the money before it arrives. So that, you know, they've got 110 million pounds for Rafinha and Calvin Phillips. By the way, they should have got so much more for Rafinha, but that's a separate topic. I think the benchmark for him was Jack Grealish. Anyway, they've brought in Brendan Aaronson, Luis Sinisterra, Tyler Adams, Rasmus Christensen. So quite a lot of new players. I guess when Spurs did that, they brought in mostly duds, Roberto Soldado being the sort of the £30 million example. So, yeah, let's see. I think Leeds are going to really struggle this year, but I think it could go either way.
Man United still haven't bought De Jong. They still haven't sold Cristiano Ronaldo. We'll talk more about that perhaps in a second or two. But Benji, what's going on with West Ham?
Oh, man, Jesse Lingard. It's like it's like a love affair that feels like it could be about to go horribly wrong.
Is it like, which pancake are we on?
Oh, that's a good question. But the problem we've got here is that by the time this podcast comes out, he might have made his decision. So I've got sort of two takes on this.
Okay.
So if he does come to West Ham, I think this will be amazing. Because it's very rare that you have a transfer where you pretty much know exactly what you're going to get and exactly how they're going to fit into your side. And with Jesse, we do. Like, it was... He only played 16 games for us in that 2021 season, but it was one of the most electrifying spells that West Ham have had, really, since Dimitri Payet. And it wasn't just the goals and the assists. He's got this thing, you know, Carl, I'm sure, will be familiar with. He's almost trademark ability to pick up the ball on the turn and create attacks. And if you've got Bowen and Antonio in front of you, it's quite terrifying for defenders. And last season, without him... which, by the way, West Ham finished on an Uncle Jeff coefficient of -9. Ooh. That was partly to do with the sort of Europa fatigue, but it was also a sort of Jesse Lingard discount, because there were lots of games that I reckon we would have got a point or would have won with him in the side. So, and he's got this infectious personality, and so yeah, no, I'd love him back. So that's the if he comes to West Ham take.
Why would he not go back? Why is he not leaping at the chance to return to a place where he enjoyed so much success, live in the capital, etc. and so on?
Because Forest are waving a lot of money in front of him. And I'm not quite sure where this has come from. Because it seems quite contrary to their transfer dealings so far. It could well be sort of the Lingard camp using Forest to get up to the kind of 180k a week that he's looking for. Who knows? Anyway, I've got to say, his kind of cachet amongst West Ham fans is like dwindling very, very quickly. And if he ends up with Forest, I mean, you know, he can f*** off, I've got to say. it's like pleading for an ex-girlfriend to take you back, and then they end up with like a kid in the year below. It's just embarrassing. And you know, he's been pissing around, dancing on TikTok all summer whilst everyone else has been pre-season training and dropping silly hints about where he's going to end up, and, you know, like a sort of like a tin pot Antoine Griezmann. So, you know, Jesse, no one cares. And by the way, if Forrest end up nicking him, you know, they've built up quite a lot of goodwill, I feel, among the neutrals over the last couple of months. It's all very romantic that they've come up, and yes, that's very nice. But that, for me, that would be over. If this goes through, and you know, I hope their mess of a squad goes straight back down.
Benji, that'll be
low. I want them to get a lower points total than Derby County did. Ooh. Derby County, by the way, that team I hugely admire. proper team with integrity and honour that maybe Forrest could learn a few things from. So, you know, go the Rams. So listen, that's James. That's how I feel about
it. You can't be getting that mad about Jesse Lingard.
He's no. got to me, Carl.
No, you can't.
He's got inside my head.
The entire time you were saying Jesse Lingard was really good, Duncan was pulling your face. And I know what that face means. That face meant outperforming XG. That was his outperforming XG phase.
Carl, you know me too well.
He ran really hot in that half season for West Ham, and he was scoring way too many. He was scoring more goals than he should have.
Yeah.
And this smacks of, if Jesse Lingard goes to West Ham, it smacks of Joe Willock getting his deal made permanent at Newcastle. Right.
Very interesting.
Like you don't need this version of Jesse Lingard. You've already had the best version of Jesse Lingard. To continue the relationship analogy, you had a lovely summer romance.
Right.
You don't need to move in together.
Football is littered with examples of players who do really well on loan and the club waiting a year or two to get them back and going, do you remember how good he was? And then they're like, right. And let's remember, Lingard's going to be 30 in December. These clubs are offering him a lot, like an absurd amount
of money.
Like 150, 180 grand a week. In the last three Premier League seasons, I know he hasn't played a lot, but he's got the same number of assists as Andy Carroll. Is that worth that much money? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I've got to say as well, I do trust David Moyes. I think that he's pragmatic, and that's why I think I'd be surprised if we get drawn into this kind of, whether it's real or not, bidding war on a 29-year-old player. We'll see. I think it'd be quite strange maybe for both clubs in that respect.
Let him go to Forest and then get him on loan in January.
you can't be paying that much. If the reported wages are true, that is... And I know inflation, and I know obviously, you know, football in 2022, money isn't real anymore and everyone's dabbling with NFTs. But that does feel like absurd overpay for a 29-year-old. That is, you're probably only going to get 18 months before the decline of a player like Jesse Lingard, a player who outstanding skill is athleticism and his interpretation of space. He's not going to get any faster. And his hot streak on shooting... is very streaky.
Do you know what, Carl?
Use that money there.
I actually think that one of the things about football that's changed is that's worth it. If you get 18 months of like exceptional Premier League footballer who can change a game and can pick you up those extra 9 points in a season, I think that is worth it. I love that
sentence you just said. I'm circling the word exceptional and I'm tapping that word. I'm going, come on, do better. Get scouting. Anyway.
Well, looking forward to seeing which way Jesse Lingard falls on this Forest-West Ham question. Amanda Breuer. There's still a shout for Amanda Breuer. Is that right, Benji?
Yeah, I quite like that one. I think Southampton fans absolutely loved him. Yeah, my slight concern is that we're looking for a player who can be back up to Antonio, and he's not that. You know, Antonio actually doesn't get the credit for how creative he is. He made 10 assists last year. Breuer got none. He's a very different sort of striker. He's like he's quite an old school centre forward, but he's got the same sort of like he can bully defenders. So I think a really really nice as a kind of alternative. To Antonio, but we'd have to play quite differently with him, I think. I don't like the idea of coming with like a buyback or like a sort of... Essentially, that's a loan. If a player comes with a buyback clause, you know. Anyway, we'll see.
Okay. Doesn't score a lot of goals, Amanda Breuer, I would say. Meanwhile, Hammer's old boy, Sebastian Haller, dramatic news for him. Have you seen he's been diagnosed with testicular cancer? Very best wishes to him. Of course, there have been plenty of people in football who have... made swift even recoveries. Francesco Cherubi was back playing really quickly after a couple of bouts of that with in Serie A, and you know, has had a great career after that, and of course countless examples in English game as well, going back a bit further. So best wishes to Sebastian Haller, who just made the move to Dortmund, of course, from Ajax. So Carl, Man United looking good down under, apart from the abuse from the crowd. And that was just Erik ten Hag shouting, "What the f*** are you doing to David De Gea?"
Yes,
ruthless, ruthless the new manager.
A stickler for detail. Very much ten Hag has a reputation for being a tracksuit manager and being meticulous in his detail. And I think that it's been a bit of a shock to United fans. Ten Hag is the first United manager to take the lead on training since David Moyes. And
you know, Manchester United were 3 goals up against a heavily rotated Crystal Palace side in preseason, yes, but the fact that he was still yelling at David De Gea and a little bit at Charlie Savage for opting to go long rather than passing short shows that he doesn't want standards to slip. I've described him a little bit as the Frankenstein's monster of every Manchester United manager since Sir Alex Ferguson's retirement. So he's got he's got a pragmatic streak similar to David Moyes.
Okay.
He's a stickler for Dutch football. From Louis van Gaal, he can be a disciplinarian and swear it from you at the touchline like Jose Mourinho, and he can, behind closed doors, be a man manager and put his arm around your shoulder like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
I don't want to know what he's taken from Ryan Giggs, but we'll just move on to the fact that it is working well so far. Rashford, Sancho and Martial. We were talking about this on Tuesday with Laurie Whitwell, from who was speaking to us from Australia, about how well things seem to be. Yeah, it just seems to be clicking up front. It would be a shame if some kind of extra body came in, having skipped all of these fun and games and spoiled all that.
It would be a shame if a certain footballing black hole would arrive at Manchester United. Ten Hag has been very bullish about the abilities of Cristiano Ronaldo, and he's saying words to the effect that good players with good talents can work in any system, and he believes Cristiano Ronaldo to be an exceptional talent. The system as it currently has been working at pre-season, with Rashford on the left, Sancho on the right hand side, and Anthony Martial often dropping deep and then bursting behind, running in behind, I'm going to be polite here, it is not impossible for a 37-year-old Cristiano Ronaldo to do that, at least below the shoulders. I think the difficulty with Cristiano Ronaldo is convincing him above the shoulders to stick in certain areas of the field and not to drift left, where he often wants to do when he thinks things aren't working.
Did you see, when you were talking about below the shoulders and that, it just came to my mind, this extraordinary report I read about him having Botox injections in his nether regions. Have you seen that story?
I did see that story, and I immediately closed whatever app I was reading it on, because it felt so bizarre.
It is a strange story. And invasive as well.
Cristiano Ronaldo, apparently, according to... this was reported in Marca?
It's
legal.
Marca, yeah.
Isn't that going to help with his leap a little bit?
No. It's more designed to improve his tackle.
Yeah, I've got some.
But hold on, Botox
images
in his bum. Have I missed something here?
No. Other side. Anyway, with this entire section destined now for the cutting room floor, let's just mention that he is still of interest to that side from Madrid, Atletico Madrid. I would love to see him play for Atletico Madrid, because it would be A, just hilarious, and B, what would he do in a Diego Simeone system? And that's a thought. Anyway, it won't happen, no doubt, but if it does, we can be talking about that next time. We've got some other things to discuss, including a bit of when Real Madrid took on Ian Holloway next.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
We're off to the Lowry in Manchester, listener, for a special season preview, Totally Football Live. That's on August the 9th, which is a Wednesday, I think. Wednesday, if you're in...
It's a Tuesday,
I'm hearing.
I bought my tickets.
Oh, nice one, Carl. I think we could have comped you, but yeah. If you're in Manchester on the 9th and would like to join Carl and Duncan, Michael Cox and Julian Laurens and myself for that, then head to thelowry.com for tickets. Duncan, you've got something special lined up, I imagine, for one of our favourite crowds.
Red hot 22-23 content. Incoming.
Really?
Yeah.
Woof.
Yeah.
Okay. I've asked for a preview, but you said no. That's absolutely for the folks who are there on the 9th of August.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. No chance.
All right, well, that's our season preview. Season, of course, is already underway for some. Shout out to Northern Irish champions Linfield, who beat last season's Euro surprises Bodo Glimt. You remember they got all the way to the Conference League quarterfinals. Anyway, they've just been beaten in the first leg of their Champions League second qualifying round match by Linfield at Windsor Park. A 1-0 win, courtesy of Kirk Millar, and some wild celebrations with Linfield players kind of headbutting each other accidentally amid all the joyous scenes. Anyway, second leg, though, coming next Tuesday inside the Arctic Circle. So, yeah, fingers crossed for Linfield in that. The Athletic's 50 best Premier League performances, now up to 13. Quick shout-out for that. Number 13 is the only Wigan player on the countdown. Anyone care to guess who it would be? The only Wigan player to make the Athletic's 50 best Premier League performances ever.
Is it Roddy Yeager?
It's not him. No. Carl?
Antonio Valencia scoring against Manchester United?
No, no, bizarrely not. Although maybe that they're saving that for, you know, the upper reaches of the top 10. I'm not sure. It is Charles Nzogbia. May 2011. Benji scoring twice as the Latics came from 2-0 down to beat West Ham 3-2. Was that a significant game, Benji?
I think it sent us down, didn't it?
It did. It sent you, Avram Grant's Hammers, down and kept Wigan up. And they've got to make that number 13 out of 50. Shocking.
Yes.
On this day, it being the 21st of July, we're on the anniversary of, in 1914, what was popularly held to be the first ever Brazil game, when a combined Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo side played the Grecians, Exeter City, that is, and beat them 2-0. Exeter City were on a kind of missionary-style tour of South America at that point. It's also the anniversary of, speaking of sides from Devon, in unexpected matchups, the 21st of July 2006, when Plymouth Argyle took on Real Madrid. On one bench, Fabio Capello. On the other, Ian Holloway. This was Ian in his pre-game press conference.
Oh, it's a belt, isn't it? Oh, what do you want me to say? You ever play Real Madrid? I'm sure they're worried about us.
How did that come about? Real Madrid wanted to go to Austria to do their pre-season training, but Fabio Capello discovered his favourite hotel had already been booked by the pilgrims. So to convince them to move to another place so he could have his preferred resort, they offered them a friendly and beat them 1-0. There you go. Do you fancy a reminisce about a World Cup that nobody liked very much? Then have we got a final part for you on today's Totally. The rest of you stick around because we'll do some hating on 2010 and that'll be fun as well.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
In the absence of our quadrennial global football get-together this June and July, we've been looking back here on Totally at some of our favourite World Cup tournaments from yesteryear. Strangely, no one has yet said World Cup 2010, the one in South Africa. Anyone like this World Cup? Carl?
I am amenable to this World Cup in a way that I know a lot of people aren't.
Right.
I think I've said on a previous podcast, it's just got a very strong flavouring to it and you can either bounce completely off it or you enjoy it. I love the sound of vuvuzelas. I love the essential dissolving of some really established football hegemonies there. So England don't have a great World Cup there. Italy get knocked out in the group stages. And obviously the final was competed by two teams that had not won a World Cup yet, which I thought was quite brilliant. I also really enjoyed that semi-final between Spain and Germany, which sort of served as a sequel to Euro 2008. That Spain team, you know, nowadays are regarded as one of the greatest international teams ever, but to get through Germany, they twice needed Carlos Puyol, which is that really nice example of you can have all the tactics of the world, but when it comes to the knife edge of international football, sometimes you need the intangible, which is punt it to the big lad, or the slightly diminutive lag with a big heart.
Fair
His
enough.
Header in the semi-final was amazing. It's one of the Thumping. Great World Cup headers.
Por qué no? Ahí va Xavi. Balón al segundo palo.
It is a really strange World Cup. I think visually,
So everyone at that, well, a number of Nike athletes at that World Cup were wearing these Mercurial Vapors, which were grey at the front and orange at the back.
Okay.
And it's just the sight of every single match. There'd be 22 players, obviously, but like at least 15 of them all had the same football boots. So it feels hyper real, unusual, and also not quite real at the same time. Yes, the football was quite dour. Spain very much needed David Villa to eke out whatever boring strangulation football they were playing at the time. But there are some charms to it. You just got to sift a bit deeper. I'm also a massive sucker for BBC's closing montage for that World Cup, which was...
What was the tune?
It was a reference to District 9. So it was sort of like a short documentary that pretended all these alien spaceships landed over South Africa.
Right.
And then all the football, all the international football teams in the world came over. And I still watch that to this day. It's one of my favourite short films. It's a really nice closing World Cup montage.
Hmm. What about you, Duncan? Where do you stand on the tournament of Vuvuzelas and the Jabulani?
Well, the Jabulani, yeah, that was... it feels like this tournament was the last pre-analytics sort of tournament, in a sense. The Jabulani kind of exaggerated how wrong... It was almost like big analytics invented the Jabulani to show people how wrong shooting from long range was. There were 983 shots from outside the box at this World Cup. In 2014, that went down to 805, and in the last World Cup, 695. So people have learned. But, I mean, it will forever be tainted, I think, by the fact that Spain won the World Cup scoring 8 goals.
Yeah.
You know, their knockout games were 1-0, 1-0, 1-0, 1-0. They completed 3,796 passes and scored 8 goals. And that is a ratio that no human should have to endure. I still wake up sometimes and, you know, crying at that statistic. So, not one of my favourites.
I do remember, I want to say partway through the knockouts, there was obviously the Jabulani conversation had reached sort of a crescendo. And Clarence Seedorf was on BBC panel and basically went, I'm going to take a bunch of these out and I'm going to go see what's wrong with it. Knocked it around 4 or 5 times. They went, I think he made a comment about the topspin. He said, if you just hit it a little less hard, it's not likely to swerve all over the place. And then you saw very few direct free kick goals in that World Cup, but Diego Forlan seemed to have figured out the Jabulani before everyone else. And I think Kuske Honda also got a direct free kick goal as well. Those were two gentlemen that seemed to have figured out that ball before everyone else. I really, really enjoy the Argentina versus Germany game because Diego Maradona coaching Lionel Messi, the image of Maradona, he was wearing two watches at the entire time of being a coach. He had one, which was South African time, and another one, which I think
Hand
was
of
local,
time.
Which was local time for Argentina because he always wanted to know what time it was where his kids were. And there's a little bit when Germany are completely dismantling Argentina and he's sort of praying and he's got these two watches together and he's looking towards Messi and Messi's looking at him going, you're the manager, do something. There's this wonderful image of Maradona hugging Messi at the end and Messi's not really reciprocating the hug back. And it's just this very Godfather 3.
Okay.
Yeah. Is that image.
Yeah, Messi had 29 shots that World Cup and didn't score, which is the most ever recorded, which I think you're right, Carl. It feels like a missed opportunity that romantic football should have seen Maradona and Messi combine for Argentina to win that tournament, but it just didn't quite work out.
Right. Carl, as you say, when you sift through a bit deeper, you do find some delights. The French bus meltdown, who can forget?
Super.
The owl on the crossbar, which is, I think, my personal... highlight. It was the last World Cup before goal line technology, which I'm not sure if it was a direct consequence of Lampard's not allowed goal against Germany, but that was a factor in its swift introduction. Benji?
Yeah, I think there's lots of little nuggets in this World Cup. Some mad goals, maybe because of the Jabulani. There was that Maicon goal versus North Korea, which is the kind of cross, but it was actually a shot. Also notable goals, Winston Reid scoring to get New Zealand their first ever World Cup point.
There'd be such jubilation for New Zealand if they could just find a goal. That's exactly what they're trying to do in these closing moments. The ball is good, and the goal is good! New Zealand incredibly have drawn the game with Slovakia, surely now.
Martin Palermo's only ever World Cup goal, and that was actually off, I think Messi had hit the post. Palermo had scored the goal in the downpour. To get Argentina to the World Cup. The Quagliarella chip against Slovakia in the game. That goal is sublime.
Yeah, but
it was Luis Fabiano's turn as Brazil's number nine. It's quite notable that Ronaldo's last World Cup was 2006, and actually since then, Brazil have never really had like a banker number nine. So it's not like a new problem for them. A few cultural notes. I thought, personally, I think the song, Shakira...
Waka Waka,
not
this
the obvious
time for Africa.
Choice. Yeah, I mean, she was inexplicably given the job, but I think she did a decent. It was a decent gig for her.
Yeah, Pitbull was busy, I think. But.
Definitely, and after the another sort of cultural note after the final.
Right.
Do you remember when Casillas was being interviewed by I think his girlfriend or wife, and he just sort of like went in for a kiss.
Yep.
I remember finding that very romantic, but actually in hindsight, probably quite problematic. And then the final beautiful little bit of trivia that I found from this. And I'm sorry to bring this up, Carl.
Right.
You know, so in the Gian quarterfinal, that quarterfinal, the Sebastian Elbreo, El Loco, he did the Panenka to win it, right? Which has got to be one of the most extraordinary Panenkas in football history. And I had a little browse of his Wikipedia page. Guess how many clubs Sebastian Elbreo, El Loco, has played for? Guess. Go on.
I'm going to say 11.
I'm 14.
11, 14, Jimbo.
14, I'm saying, yeah.
Duncan?
I'm going Trevor Benjamin-esque 21.
No, he played for 37 clubs.
Jeepers.
How? Only, what
the hell?
El Loco, he was Loco for a signing on fee. He only retired last year, apparently.
What?
I think it's exactly.
So how many seasons did he pack those 37 clubs into?
I think he started in 95 and finished in 2021. So
that's amazing.
26 seasons.
That's amazing. All right, well, you know what? You mentioned the quarterfinal Uruguay against Ghana. We should probably finish off on that. Not least because, yes, they will be facing, there's the rematch on the 2nd of December in Qatar because they're both in that group together. Who else is in that group, Carl?
Portugal and South Korea.
I see.
The closest, I think that's probably... the closest thing to a group of death, if not by FIFA coefficient, but in terms of,
and
very good third place.
Certainly a group of narrative with this rematch. This was the tournament that had seen the first ever goal for all of Africa when South Africa scored against Mexico in the opening game. But it also almost saw the first African nation reaching the semifinals, that nation being Ghana, denied by that infamous Luis Suarez handball. Crikey. Asamoah Gyan, then the penalty was awarded, and Asamoah Gyan then missed, and it went to the shootout. And then, as you mentioned, Benji Uruguay with that bit of flair from Abreu went through
painful,
the semifinal.
Painful though.
Asamoah Gyan, can I ask you about his kind of role, his place in the kind of Ghanaian football legacy?
He is a very strange character in that he has missed two very noteworthy penalties for Ghana during what is now regarded as their golden age. So not only did he miss that penalty in 2010, but also in the 2012 AFCON semi-finals against Zambia, he also missed the penalty. And at least one of his buildings was marched on upon a large group of disappointed Ghanaian fans who slightly simmered it. In protest of what he did there.
They set fire to a building that he owned.
The building might have been one of his houses.
I see.
But he is the top scorer in Ghanaian football. He has a very interesting reputation in that he probably played for the Ghanaian national team a bit too long and he needed to be replaced, but also there was no direct successor as the number nine. Obviously, he wore the number three because he believed it to be a number that gave him great power, which I thought was quite funny. And he just released a book this year called Le Gianderi, which I think is a phenomenal title for an autobiography.
Le Gianderi. He's been a recording artiste, a big hit with African Girls, as performing as Baby Jet with Ghanaian rapper Castro. Song released, I think, just after the World Cup, and certainly in 2010. Castro, phenomenally successful Ghanaian rapper who subsequently disappeared and has been declared essentially dead while on holiday with Asamoah Gyan in what was probably a jet ski accident. But there were some strange rumours circulating. I don't know if Asamoah goes into that at all in Legendary, but might be worth flicking through to see that. Hmm.
We should probably just give a quick mention to the disappointment of England's tournament before everyone was like, it's going to be winter in South Africa, that will really suit the English players, yeah, and they'll be have loads more energy. Well, they didn't have much. Sort of scraped through the group stage, Wayne Rooney saying, nice to hear your own fans booing you. And then the Germany game, which obviously we talked about the Lampard goal that never was, but I think it might have been the last time Mesut Ozil outpaced anyone as well. Gareth Barry really couldn't catch him. That midfield, actually, England had Milner, Lampard, Barry and Gerrard, which it does feel like the last scrapings of the golden generation. And then obviously 2014 wasn't successful, but did feel like a sort of, you know, gateway to a new era, I guess, with your Ricky Lamberts and your Adam Lallanas. So,
indeed. Yeah. We did have a man in the final, though, in 2010.
Well,
that
yeah.
That man being Howard Webb.
That man's now come back to save us. So in many ways, he's got a story arc like Obi-Wan Kenobi, you know, scarred by a horrifically violent incident, goes into exile, but now is coming back with greater understanding. So.
And he used to work in the Force as well.
Exactly.
He showed 9 yellow cards to the Dutch. This is how we're talking about. Referee for the Spain-Netherlands World Cup final. 9 yellow cards to the Dutch, 14 in total. By far the most bookings ever in a World Cup final. And yet missed the biggest one of all, Nigel de Jong.
There was, a couple of years ago, a phenomenal article from Jonathan Liu that essentially looked at Howard Webb's entire categorisation of cards and made the argument that that World Cup final completely changed his approach to handing out cards, and he became just a lot less card frequent after that World Cup final. It was almost, there's a dramatic shift in how he referees games after that point.
Interesting. He's a lovely chap, by the way, Howard Webb, if you're curious, having been a co-worker of mine or vice versa on various occasions. He's an absolutely lovely chap and talks a lot of sense. And he's going to become the chief refereeing officer at Pogmore after Mike Riley stepped
down. He should do a Clattenburg and get like Nigel de Jong's studs tattooed on his arm.
Nice.
To commemorate the peak of his career. Yeah, Clattenburg did that. Was it the Champions
Clattenburg
League?
Has the Champions League, the Euro 2016 final, and he's got one more tournament tattooed on his sleeve.
Okay.
His autobiography is phenomenal. It is truly, truly Partridge levels of needless to say, I had the last laugh.
All right. Well, I think that might have been the last laugh for us, actually, listener, because we've reached, I believe, the end of today's Totally Football show. Yes, there is another one along on Monday, looking ahead to the semi-finals of Euro 2022. Not sure if there's any World Cups left for us to look back on. Possibly there might be. We'll be detailing the latest news from the transfer front and other things as well. Send us in a question, perhaps, if you'd like to participate. For now, though, many thanks for being with us. Thank you so much to Carl, Benji, Duncan, and producer Charlie. And have a great weekend, and we'll catch up with you next time.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.